Seems we live in a culture of meaningless symbols. Business logos today, they may represent an important thing about that company, and they may not. Sometimes a logo just looks cool, and they hope it'll be memorable. The cross is unquestionably a familiar symbol. Unfortunately, in history, the cross has been misused at times. The Crusades, the Middle Ages, as Christian governments used the cross as a symbol of the victorious sword for one Christian nation to overtake another non-Christian nation by force. More in our lifetime, the KKK uses the cross with its ritual cross burnings. Maybe more close to home, it's for some just a good luck charm around the neck. Or a cool piece of jewelry. I remember in the 80s, Madonna made it a very popular thing. Maybe some today see the cross representing a constituency of right-wing politics. Well, the cross rightly doesn't represent any of these things, but we are right to assume the cross is a symbol. That's in the Bible. The Apostle Paul often summarizes his message as just this: Christ crucified. Two words. 1 Corinthians 1:23. We preach Christ crucified. The summation of his message: Christ crucified. And then one chapter later, I determined to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ and him crucified. The summary of my theology, of my epistemology, of my thought, my motivation, and my message to you is Christ and him crucified. Paul also said that the cross is the only thing that he would boast in. Boast. It means literally to revel in, to rejoice in, to trust in, and to proclaim. So Galatians 5:14, he says, may it never be that I would boast in anything except in the cross of our Lord Jesus Christ. What does he mean? The literal wooden cross that somewhere probably got buried or used again or who knows what? Does he mean that literal wooden cross? No. Throughout the New Testament, phrases like his death, the cross, crucified, these are used as shorthand for the whole message. The whole message of Christ and his life and his teaching and his death and his salvation and our hope. The symbol of the cross throughout history has at times been misused and abused, sure, but there's no denying that it has been the church's central, if not only, symbol. Think about this. The symbol of Christianity is not a manger signifying his birth. The symbol of Christianity is not a cloud signifying his ascension. You could think of others between the birth and perhaps the ascension that might symbolize something of the Christ. But the central picture is that of his cross where he died. What more can be said about the meaning of the cross? Well, as we come to a time of year like this weekend to give intense focus to the cross, let me share with you five aspects to the symbolism of the cross. First, the cross is a symbol of ironic injustice. Ironic injustice. Listen to the words of Acts 3:13-15, where Peter says, "The God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God of our fathers, has glorified his servant Jesus, the one whom you delivered and disowned in the presence of Pilate when he had decided to release him. But you disowned the holy and righteous one and asked for a murderer to be granted to you. And you put to death the Prince of Life." This is how it's put in 1 Corinthians 2:8. "None of the rulers of this age has understood, for if they had understood, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory." The cross is a symbol of ironic injustice. I put on our church blog this week a bit from a book called Jesus on Trial. James Montgomery Boyce and Philip Ryken are the authors, and they talk about the conspiracies that finally led to the examination, to the trial, to the death sentence of Jesus, and finally his execution. They show seven different ways in which people were involved, different groups of people were involved in conspiracy against him. Judas as one, the Roman leaders as another, the Jewish leaders as another, and the crowd. It's ironic how it seems like it's a perfect storm, all coming together, conspiring against Jesus. And yet, one of the things we'll see here tonight is that this was God's plan all along. But don't miss the fact that the cross is a symbol of ironic injustice. They crucified the Prince of Life. They crucified the Lord of Glory. You crucified an innocent man. Secondly, the cross is a symbol of suffering and death. Think of the physical pain of the cross. Maybe you can't imagine. Maybe you haven't seen a movie like Mel Gibson's movie of Christ and his crucifixion. But know this, the Romans had perfected the slow, painful execution of crucifixion. Oh, if it meant death would come too soon, they would change things up. They constantly tested and evolved the way in which they would crucify someone so that it would be as publicly shameful, as painful, and as prolonged as possible. The pain of the cross is more excruciating than probably any other death pain we could imagine. But there's also the public shame of the crucifixion, which is part of the plan of crucifixion. There's the mockery of putting the king's robe on Jesus. Put a purple robe on him because he looks like a naked, beat-up king. Get a robe for him. But he needs a crown, doesn't he? So get some thorns and put him into a crown. And when they seem to fall down, then push it down on his head further. You're a king, right? Here's your purple. Here's your crown. There's the mockery of putting a sign over his head that says, King of the Jews. Remember, the Jews wanted it to read instead, he said that he was the King of the Jews. Even worse, everyone knew when it said the King of the Jews, it was mockery. The Jews apparently didn't take a good joke. They wanted to be literalists and said, make it say he said he's not the King of the Jews. They spit upon him. They hurled insults. Remember this? They punched him from behind and said, if you're a prophet, tell us who hit you. As if Jesus couldn't do that. But to fulfill what it said in Isaiah 53, that he was led like a lamb to the slaughter, and he kept his mouth shut just like a lamb. He didn't say a thing. As if it would be difficult for him to know who hit him. And when it gets to finally being crucified on the cross and being hung up there like a piece of meat, he's naked. And the soldiers there say, if you really are the Son of God, the men next to him say, if you really are the Son of God, get yourself down from the cross. Some saw this crucifixion like the soldiers up close. Some saw it from afar, really far. As they were on their donkeys going across the field or the road, they saw this man, well, really three men, on a hill being crucified, and it was nothing unusual. That's the death of common criminals. That's the death of the really bad people, and you see it all the time. And if you're a good mom or dad, you shield the eyes of your kids from seeing the horror of the crucifixion. But this is no special crucifixion. If you don't know who this Jesus is, you, You just walk by. You just keep going. Perhaps you don't want your kids to see the violence, but nothing more. In first century Roman culture, the cross was not just a symbol of judicial punishment, but it was also a symbol of cultural rejection. It meant being cast out. It meant public condemnation. It meant public humiliation. The community was supposed to hurl insults, supposed to spit, supposed to turn their eyes in horror of what they were seeing. Our king, for some, was just seen as a common criminal worth absolutely no special notice whatsoever. Third, think about the cross as a symbol of desertion and shame. Desertion and shame. He was deserted by his own people, the Israelites. Matthew 27, in verse 21, again, remember, the governor said to them, "Which of the two do you want me to release for you?" And they said, "Not Jesus. Give us Barabbas. Give us the known criminal. Give us the known thief." Pilate said to them, "Well, what shall I do with this Jesus who you call Christ?" And they said, "Crucify him." He said, "What has he done?" But they kept shouting all the more, "Crucify him." Pilate knows this is conspiracy. He just doesn't have the guts enough to acknowledge it and say, this isn't justice. He says it isn't justice, and he washes his hands to say, you're at fault, not me, but he goes ahead with the crucifixion. Forsaken by his people, forsaken by his friends. Remember, his disciples all fled, all of them. Jesus said they would do this. He said, when they strike the shepherd, the sheep will scatter. Oh, Peter was there. Peter was there to watch and then to three times acknowledge that he's not with him. He's not with Jesus. I'm not one of his followers. He's forsaken by us all. Isaiah 53 prophesied hundreds of years before Christ came, that he would be despised and forsaken of men, a man of sorrows, acquainted with grief, and like one from whom men hid their face. He was despised, and we did not esteem him. That means all of us. We too have forsaken him. Even if you now believe, you forsook him. You had to be convinced that he was the Lord of glory. You would have been no different than the disciples, no different than Peter, maybe far worse. You would have been those who said, crucify him, crucify him. That's not my kind of king. But even worse, he was forsaken by his father. His father, God. He cried out from the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? We know now what that means. We know now that he was bearing the sins of his people and the Father could not look upon him. We know now that it was temporary. For the disciples who heard it live for the first time, God is forsaking the one we followed. Fourthly, the cross is a symbol of divine judgment. In Jewish culture, the cross is a curse. It said in the Old Testament, cursed is everyone who hangs upon a tree. But in the New Testament, it's even clearer. The cross, it's suffering, it's death. They represent Jesus bearing the punishment for sin and for sin that he didn't commit. The Bible calls this propitiation. It's a big word. It's in our Bibles. Propitiation means bearing wrath. Jesus was bearing God's wrath upon the cross. He was bearing the wrath that God had toward our sin, the wrath of a holy God. The wrath of his Father to bring us to him. So the violence and the pain and the ugliness, the horror of the cross shows us something of the odium and the severity and the heinousness, the evil of the sin that the cross intended to take care of. You see, if our condition as sinners was less serious than it is, we could be saved by something prettier than the cross. If our state, our condition was maybe neater and cleaner and more innocent than it is, then the means of our salvation, I presume, would be something more clean, more innocent, less painful, less horrible, less terrifying, and less shameful. And lastly, the cross is a symbol of the climax of God's plan. The cross is not just some unfortunate turn of events. It's actually the plan. It's not part of the plan, it's the plan. Again, what did Jesus say the week before the Passion Week? In Matthew 20, he said, "We are going to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be delivered to the chief priests and scribes, and they will condemn him to death and hand him over to the Gentiles to mock and scourge and crucify him. And on the third day, he'll be raised up." You know what comes after this in Matthew 20? The disciples wondering who is going to get the greatest seat in the kingdom. Oh, we know now that it was really dumb. Really, really dumb. He just said he's going to be crucified. He just said this is the plan. And somehow you missed it, like you were thinking about yourself. You were thinking about what you wanted to ask next. Missed what he said, and then just go ahead and shoot it out there. So which one of us will be greatest in the kingdom? Ironic as it is, Jesus tells us in Matthew 20 that this is the plan. He tells it in very specific detail. And then looking backwards, the apostles, his disciples, Peter specifically, as he preaches in Acts 2, says, this man, Jesus, was delivered over by the predetermined plan and foreknowledge of God. This man you nailed to a cross by the hands of godless men and put him to death. Oh, you see, personal responsibility here. You nailed him to a tree. And you see God's sovereignty here. That was his plan all along. That was his plan? Yeah, it's repeated two chapters later as the early church prays. For truly in this city, there were gathered together against your holy servant Jesus, Herod and Pontius Pilate, along with the Gentiles and the peoples of Israel, to do whatever your hand and your purpose predestined to occur. So who is responsible for the death of Jesus? The Romans? Yes. The Jews? Yes. The crowd? Yes. Us? Yes. God himself? Yes. This was all part of God's plan. And that's clear in the story because something cosmic happened as he died. Several things, in fact. There was an earthquake. The sky turned dark in the middle of the day. I don't know how. I'm not supposed to tell you how that happened on a science level. The Bible doesn't tell us. I just know that God can make it happen probably about a million different ways. So I'm okay with just trusting that it happened. The sky turned black in the middle of the day. And there was also the tearing of the veil in the temple. That veil that separated God's intimate, holy sacrifice presence from everything else. It's not in the Bible, but it was said in ancient history that the veil was a fabric as thick as a man's hand is wide. I don't own any shirts that thick. That's thick. It was torn in two. It was not torn in two because someone thought it was a good idea. It was not torn in two because someone snuck in with a knife and did it real quick. It was not torn in two for any reason that man could come up with. It was a symbol of what God was doing, that he was now breaking open wide his presence to humanity. Jesus now is the sacrifice. And it's then that one of the centurion, one of the soldiers who's crucifying Jesus, says, "Surely this man was the Son of God." But notice he says, "was." Oh, I looked it up in the Greek. It's past tense. It's not a mistake in our English Bibles. "Surely this man was the Son of God." He knows something's there, but he died. He knows something is profound about this guy, but he still died. He's dying or dead as he says this. "Surely this man was great. Surely this man was the Son of God." And he said, "It is finished." He said, "Into your hands, Father, I commend my spirit." And he breathed his last and he died. And that's where we end the story tonight. That's where the story ends tonight, because we put ourselves in the shoes of those. In the words of Luke 24, those who stood at a distance watching these things. Like the centurion, like Peter, like Mary, like other disciples, we stand at a distance tonight anyway, watching these things and return home, beating our breasts. So we're going to ask you to leave tonight like them. It's weird, it's awkward. It's like a funeral because someone has died. We leave tonight in a spirit of soberness and somber reflection. I'm going to pray in just a second, and that will dismiss us. That will be our dismissal. No closing song, no announcements afterwards, no refreshments or cookies. Your kids will ask, "Why aren't there cookies tonight?" I know. Tell them. Because Jesus died. I need to go home. He died. Go home and read the story. Read it again. I know you've read it. Read it again. Read it with new eyes. Read it with putting yourself into the story. If not tonight, read it tomorrow. And then come back here Sunday morning. There's more to the story. 99% of you know there's more to the story. It's okay to leave here pondering this part of the story for just a night. Leaving ourselves in this part of the story for just a day or so. And we come back Sunday morning to hear more. Oh, there's more to the story. And there's more than just that Sunday. That's for later.